So amidst the cut and thrust of a pre-election build-up, there's this other thing, isn't there, that also goes on, as well as standing behind lecterns and rubbishing the policies of their rivals. Our leaders like also to sit on sofas on daytime TV programmes, in Theresa May's case talking about who puts the bins out in her household, in Jeremy Corbyn's case talking about his love of making jam, and so it goes on. In these instances then, I suppose these people are trying to reveal their soft side. And in the final paragraph then of Hebrews chapter 4, our writer has revealed something of Jesus' soft side. He has made other emphases in this letter. You think of chapter 1 verse 13. And he has depicted Jesus there using the language of an Old Testament psalm. He has depicted Jesus there as this strong, conquering figure whose enemies are going to end up beneath his feet. And often, of course, that's the emphasis we find in the New Testament. Jesus is the lion of the tribe of Judah. He is this sword-wielding, mighty, conquering king. But here in that last paragraph of chapter 4, the writer has emphasized instead Jesus' soft side. He has highlighted particularly Jesus' sympathy. And it's only then by appreciating that that's the case, that Jesus' soft side has been revealed in that final paragraph of chapter 4, it's only by appreciating that that we may properly make sense of this passage that we're looking at this morning, chapter 5, verses 1 to 10. And I would like us to look at this passage under two headings. First of all then, in his softness, Jesus is recognizable. That's our first heading. In his softness, Jesus is recognizable. And this is verses 1 to 4. Now, I suppose that this passage we're dealing with this morning, Hebrews 5, 1 to 10, it kind of lives a bit in the shadow, doesn't it, of that previous paragraph, that last paragraph of chapter 4. The female members of my family can't understand why there's a new Anne of Green Gables film that has just come out. It's obviously covering the same terrain as the one that came out 20 years ago or whenever it was. But the old one was so good that this new one is deemed quite unnecessary. And I suppose we might think the same with Hebrews 5 verses 1 to 10. That it's covering kind of the same terrain as that last paragraph of chapter 4. And certainly toward the end of chapter 5, 1 to 10, we can see that a bit more clearly. But it somehow just lacks the clarity of that final paragraph of chapter 4. It lacks the beauty. It lacks the distinctiveness of that paragraph. And you kind of think, well, why is it necessary? Isn't it a bit of a damp squib, a bit of an anticlimax after those epic words there? But I think we need to put on for a moment the spectacles of the first readers of this letter, or perhaps we should try and hear the letter, would be a better way of saying it, hear the letter as they would have heard it. Because you see, there in that final paragraph of chapter 4, the writer is saying then that there's this priest Jesus, this great high priest Jesus, and there's this wonderful softness to him. He has this wonderful soft side, and he then is the real priest. He's the great priest. He's the true priest. He's the priest to whom all former priests were really pointing all along. But you see, to these first listeners, that would have sounded really rather odd. Because in their minds, softness wasn't particularly a qualification of priesthood. They didn't think of priests, of high priests, in those terms. They would have had two main categories in which they thought of high priesthood. A high priest, on the one hand, his purpose was to atone for sins. They would have thought very much in terms of atonement. And then secondly, they would have thought very much in terms of the dignity and the honour and the augustness of the high priestly office. So those are the two concepts that would have dominated for them. A high priest, he atoned for sins, and a high priest, he was a very glorious and august individual within the Israelite community. And this business then of softness, just wouldn't really have resonated with them. I mean, it's like sometimes people make the comment, don't they, that, you know, I've got this great odd job man who comes to my house, he's so friendly. And you kind of think, well, I'm not really all that bothered about whether he's friendly or not. Is he good with a drill? Can he paint? Can he do odd jobs? That's really the main thing. And I think that these listeners would have responded to that paragraph a little bit like that. Well, this great high priest you're telling us about, Jesus, he's got this soft side to him. Well, so what? What's that got to do with it? That would have been their reaction. Well, notice then how in verses 1 to 4 of our passage, the writer responds to that. And indeed, he affirms that yes, on the one hand, the high priest, his purpose was to atone for sins. That's what he says in verse 1. Every priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. So yes, he affirms that that was the purpose, atonement. And he also affirms in verse 4, that there was a certain honour and there's a certain dignity attached to the role. He uses that word honour. No one takes his honour for himself. And so the writer affirms that those two categories that would have dominated in their minds, they're not wrong categories. But nonetheless, he shows in these first four verses that those Old Covenant high priests, those Old Testament high priests, they also had a soft side. There was a soft side to them. And there are two aspects to this then. First of all, he mentions their understanding. Their understanding. Verse 2, he can deal gently. So here he's talking about these Old Covenant high priests. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. So I suppose it's a danger for a teacher, particularly a teacher then who is very au fait with their subject, as hopefully most teachers are, and they have a pupil then, and the pupil just can't get it, and keeps making mistakes in maths or geography or whatever it might be. And I suppose the temptation for the teacher is just to really kind of lose it with this pupil. Why can't you understand this? Now, Hannah has vivid memories of a maths teacher who was like that, and he was always inviting them to come and ask if they couldn't understand something. And on one occasion, he explained something at great length, and Hannah immediately went up and said, I don't understand it, and he kind of tore a strip off her. And the priest then could potentially have been like that. That here were these Israelites coming as sinners, needing sacrifices for their sins, and the priests then, they could have kind of torn a strip off them and said, well, why have you committed these sins? You foolish people, why are you sinning? But no, they weren't like that, the writer says. They were gentle. They dealt gently with Israelites who had failed and fallen and needed sacrifice for sins. And he goes on to say why that was so in verse 3. Because this, he is bound to offer sacrifice for his own sins just as he does for those of the people. It's because they themselves were sinners. They knew what it was to sin. They often failed. And so they were gentle toward these Israelites who were coming as failures, needing sacrifice for sins. And so that's one aspect then of this soft side of the Old Covenant priests, their understanding. And then secondly, their unassertiveness. Their unassertiveness. Verse 4, no one takes this honour for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. So these priests then, it wasn't this career that they kind of pursued with ruthless ambition. We're going to push ourselves to the very top and become high priests. We're going to trample over all our rivals, and we're going to get there, and we're going to make it, and we're going to take that office. It wasn't like one of these shows on TV to find the next star in a West End show where they kind of work through the rounds and they're all competing with each other to get the job. It wasn't like that for these high priests. No, they didn't push themselves forward. There was an unassertiveness. They simply accepted God's appointment in this matter. They were called by God. Not sure that it necessarily means that there was some individual direct call to every one of them, but the call, I suppose, came in the simple form that they were in the line of Aaron. They were Aaron's descendants. And that's why they could become the high priest. But the point is, they didn't push themselves forward into that role. It wasn't about ambition and attainments. And so the writer here then is saying, look, there are these aspects of old covenant priesthood that you've missed. That there was always a soft side to priesthood. That these men had a soft side, number one, in that they had an understanding, a gentleness toward sinners coming for sacrifices. Because they themselves were sinners who also needed sacrifices. And there was this unassertiveness also about them. And his point is then that when I'm now describing Jesus, the great high priest, as having a soft side, I'm not kind of coming up with some novel definition of priesthood. I'm not redefining priesthood. I'm not depicting Jesus as some weird new type of priest because he has a soft side. No, it's recognizable. You can see this in all the old covenant priests. And Jesus then, in his softness, he's in continuity with them. It's recognizable. And so that's the first thing that the writer is saying here. Verses 1 to 4, he's saying in his softness, Jesus is recognizable. But then secondly, he's saying that in his softness, Jesus is radical. In his softness, Jesus is radical. And this is verses 5 to 10. Because you could think that the writer then has rather shot himself in the foot here. He's rather undermined his own arguments. He's saying that here's this great high priest, Jesus. He's the real one and he has this wonderful soft side to him. But now he's saying that all the old covenant priests had a soft side to them as well. Well, what's the big deal about Jesus then? Could come the rejoinder. And that's kind of what he's addressing in verses 5 to 10. And he's saying in these verses then that yes, in his softness, Jesus is recognizable. There's a certain continuity with old covenant priesthood, but also in his softness, Jesus is radical. There's distinctiveness about Jesus' softness. And so he kind of now talks about Jesus through these same two categories he's just mentioned in connection with the old covenant priests, only he reverses the order. So he talks first about Jesus' unassertiveness. Because he says in verse 5, then that Jesus, similarly, like those old covenant priests, he didn't exalt himself to be made a high priest. He didn't push himself forward either. It wasn't a matter of ruthless ambition for him. It wasn't this career thing for him either. But he was appointed by God. So in verse 10, he uses a language of designation. He was designated by God. So Jesus' softness then is similar to the softness of these old covenant high priests in that he too was unassertive, but there's something radical about Jesus' unassertiveness. Because in his case then, the divine appointment to which he submits himself, it's so much greater, isn't it, than the divine appointment to which those old covenant priests submitted themselves. Look at the language that he uses in those two Old Testament quotations. God said to him, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you." Now, God never said that to any son of Aaron, to any old covenant high priest. Yes, they were all divine appointments to the job, but never in these terms. Never God saying this kind of thing to them. And of course, the writer has already spelt out, fleshed out something of what he means by, or something of what the scriptures mean by that term son in chapter 1. And Jesus' sonship in all its glory and transcendence has been described, hasn't it? And so God never said such things to any of the old priests. Or then verse 6, God also said to him, "You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." And the writer kind of leaves this hanging here, and he's going to, of course, explain this in much greater detail when he comes to chapter 7. But again, already, it's evident there's something radical about this. Because again, God didn't say that to the Aaronic priests in the Old Testament. They were priests in the order of Aaron. He never said to them, "You're a priest forever," after the order of Melchizedek. And so you see then what I'm saying, that there's this continuity. They were unassertive. They just complied with God's appointment. Jesus too, unassertive, complied with God's appointment. In his case, God's appointment is something radical. It's appointment to a greater role. Its terms are so much more exalted. So he focuses in verses 5 and 6 on Jesus' unassertiveness. But then in verses 7 to 9, he focuses on Jesus' understanding. On Jesus' understanding. And again then, he's saying that there's continuity here. Those old covenant high priests, they were understanding men. And similarly, this great high priest, Jesus, is an understanding high priest. But again, there's something radical about this. And this really is the main point of the whole passage. And so I just want to spend a little bit longer on this and try and really get to grips with what he's saying. You see, we read earlier on, didn't we, from Leviticus chapters 21 and 22. And that passage stressed then that the high priest must be perfectly holy. The high priest must be perfectly holy. His role, after all, is to approach a holy God, so he had to be spotlessly holy. But of course that presented a problem, didn't it? Which descendant of Aaron was spotlessly holy? Well, of course none of them was. And so instead then of a moral heart spotlessness, which was unrealistic, the requirement for these high priests was a kind of external physical spotlessness. No blindness, no lameness, no skin defects, and so the list goes on. But of course, that was no real substitute for heart perfection. It was a picture. That external physical spotlessness that was required of those old covenant high priests, it was a mere picture of the real holiness that was required of the high priest. Now, do you see we've hit upon a tension here? Because you see, verses 2 and 3 of our passage, Hebrews 5, they're saying that those old covenant high priests, they had a real understanding of the people that they were serving because they were fellow sinners with them. And that seems like a positive thing then. They could understand where the Israelites were coming from because they were sinners too. It seems like a positive thing, and yet actually the thing that enabled them to have this understanding of the people they were serving was the very thing that disqualified them from really fulfilling the high priestly role and really atoning for sins. It meant that they lacked the requisite moral holiness. So I'm saying that yes, as fellow sinners, those old priests, they had bucket loads of understanding. They had bucket loads of sympathy. But as fellow sinners, precisely because they were fellow sinners, they couldn't actually atone for the people's sins. They couldn't actually do the very thing that high priesthood really existed for. Jesus, on the other hand, he was spotlessly holy, not in some merely pictorial, external, physical sense, but in the moral, heart sense. Or in the language of verses 7 to 9, he was obedient to God, perfectly obedient to God. And hence, then, he could, unlike all his predecessors, he could genuinely atone for sins. Verse 9, he became the source of eternal salvation. Because of his moral perfection, because of his spotless obedience to God, he actually achieved salvation. He actually atoned. He became the source of eternal salvation. But this is the thing. As a human being, he had to learn that obedience. Now, of course, Jesus wasn't only a human being. He was the Son of God. Again, chapter 1 has spelt that out in great detail, and we're reminded of it here. Verse 8, although he was a son. So he wasn't only a human being, but nonetheless he was an authentic human being. And of course it belongs to the nature of human beings that we learn things. We all start out as helpless babies with no knowledge and no skills, and everything has to be learned. It goes with the territory of being human. And so this obedience then of Jesus' obedience to God that would enable him to truly atone for our sins, it had to be learnt. Now, how is obedience to God learnt? Well, it's learnt, the writer says, through suffering. Why through suffering? Well, because suffering makes obedience hard. If you want to learn to be a really good sailor, you have at some point to take a boat out in stormy conditions, because stormy conditions make sailing hard. If you want to learn to be a really good tennis player, you have at some point to play against an opponent who will bombard you with low, fast, accurate shots, because being bombarded with low, fast, accurate shots makes playing tennis hard. In the same way then, you learn to really obey God through suffering, because suffering makes obedience hard. So when Jesus then was growing up in that home in Nazareth, always, of course, he was obedient to God. There was never a single instance in which he was disobedient to God. But that obedience to God in those 30 years, it wasn't magnificent, heroic obedience to God, of the kind that was needed to atone for his people's sins, because it hadn't yet had to contend with any great suffering. Similarly, when his public ministry began at the age of 30, and he spent those 3 years traveling around teaching, again, he was always obedient to God. There was never a single instance in which he was disobedient, but again, it wasn't this magnificent, heroic obedience of the kind that was needed to atone for his people's sins, because he hadn't had to contend yet with any great suffering. But then, of course, at the end of those 3 years, Jesus entered a new situation, and he suffered. Verse 7 again uses the D word, doesn't it? What was it that he suffered? He suffered death. Remember, that was stressed in chapter 2, verse 9, the suffering of death. And it was death then that Jesus had to suffer. And boy, he found it hard. It stretched him to his very limits, so that according to verse 7, he had to offer up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. That's often traditionally been associated with Jesus' experiences in the Garden of Gethsemane. I think it's probably actually talking about Jesus' experiences on the cross itself. I'll explain the reasons for that in a moment. But the main point is, of course, that his suffering was intense. It drew from him these expressions of anguish and agony. And this obedience to God then, in that context of severe, intense suffering, it was way harder than his obedience to God in Nazareth as a teenager, or his obedience to God during those 3 years of his public ministry. This was really hard obedience to God. And yet he did it. He obeyed perfectly even then. Verse 7 ends that he was heard because of his reverence. Now that seems a bit odd, doesn't it? That he cried out to him who was able to save him from death, and the writer says he was heard. Now, of course, Jesus wasn't saved from death. He died. But I think the point is that he cried out to be saved not from dying, but to be saved out of death. Once he had died, which of course is what happened in the resurrection. This isn't talking about prayer for an avoiding of the cross, but prayer for salvation, the other side of the cross, which is what he did experience. And this is why I think it cannot be a reference to Gethsemane, because of course in Gethsemane he was praying that the cross might not happen at all, wasn't he? He was praying that the cup might be removed. He was praying that he wouldn't have to die at all. And you can't say then that he was heard in that prayer, because he wasn't. God didn't answer that prayer. Rather, this, it seems to me, is talking about Jesus' prayers, his cries when he was on the cross. We know, don't we, that Psalm 22 meant a lot to Jesus as he was on the cross. And he certainly quoted its opening words, and he seems to have alluded to its closing words. Probably he also reflected deeply and perhaps actually spoke all the words in between. And in verses 20 and 21 of Psalm 22, you can look it up yourselves, you have the sufferer, the Messiah there, crying out for to be saved, to be delivered. Now, it's not to be delivered from the suffering, because he already is suffering. But to be delivered kind of the other side of the suffering. And I think that's what the writer is referring to here. But the point is, there at the end of verse 7, he was heard because of his reverence, that is his obedience. He obeyed perfectly. And this now then, this obedience in the context of such suffering, this is magnificent, heroic obedience of the kind that's needed to atone for his people's sins. Now, what all this means then is that Jesus, the real, the ultimate, the true high priest, he does have this understanding of his people that I've been talking about this morning, but it's a different sort of understanding from that which those old covenant high priests had. So, no, when you have messed up, when you have sinned, and you go to Jesus, he won't say, oh, I understand that, because I've been there, because I've sinned, and I've messed up too. Jesus can't offer that kind of understanding, because he did never sin. He did never mess up. He doesn't have that sort of understanding, the understanding of a fellow sinner. But when you're striving to obey God in your Christian life, and you're finding it really tough, perhaps because of suffering, or perhaps just because it is tough, and you're finding it hard, and you're struggling to keep on obeying God, and you go to Jesus then, certainly then he says, I understand that, because I've been there. I've had to obey God when it was really, really tough. And I remember it in great detail. And I remember that Passion Weekend. And I remember having the nails hammered through my flesh. And the temptation at that moment to run away from this appointment with death for which God had sent me into the world. The temptation at that point to defy my Father and say, no, I'm not doing this. But I kept on going. And I understand then. I understand that obeying God can be really, really, really hard. That's the understanding that Jesus has. And it's a better sort of understanding, actually. Not the understanding of a fellow sinner, but the understanding of a fellow sufferer. Because actually, when you have sinned and when you have messed up, it's not understanding you want, is it really? It's pardon that you want. It's the knowledge that it's been dealt with. It's been atoned. And Jesus can give you that. It's not understanding that you want when you've messed up. But it is understanding that you want when you're struggling to keep obeying God against battle after battle after battle. That's what these Hebrew believers were facing. They were experiencing some forms of suffering, it seems, some ostracism at least, discrimination because of their Christian faith from their fellow Jews. And it was hard then. It was hard to keep on obeying God. And perhaps you're finding it hard this morning. Perhaps in a very particular way. I mean, we all always find it hard, I guess, generally. But perhaps in a very particular way, you're finding it hard this morning to just keep on obeying God. Because you're finding it tough through suffering, tough for other reasons. And I'm saying you can go to Jesus, and he understands that. He understands that perfectly. His memories of Calvary are vivid. He's been there. And as we said last week, he will therefore ensure that you get precisely the resources you need to get through this battle. So his soft side is better than the soft side of the old covenant high priests. It's not that he will put his arm around you and say, oh yeah, I remember when I messed up as well. Yeah, I sinned one time when I lashed out at so-and-so, and another time I coveted something that wasn't mine. And he doesn't offer that sort of understanding to you, but you don't want that. He offers you this understanding. I've struggled to obey God against all the odds. And I know what that's like, and I'll make sure that you get everything you need to keep on obeying and make it all the way to the end of the race. Amen.